I thought the one story I would tell was that I hadn't been here too long at Station Q, and Mike had mentioned some math problem to me, and I had made some progress on it, and I'd been explaining what I'd done to Mike. And then the next day I got this phone call, and it was because Mike and Kevin were driving up to go mountain climbing in the east side of the Sierras, and I guess they had all their gear, but they didn't have any mathematics to talk about. So Mike wanted me to remind him what I'd done so he and Kevin would have something to talk about. And when they came back the next day, I guess not only had they climbed the mountain, but they had had a lot of new ideas on this problem. So even when he's not working, he's still working. So the topic I'm going to talk about, as they said, is as Parsa said, is called quantum belief propagation. And this is a topic that it's going to combine sort of ideas from computation and physics and quantum information theory. Let me first explain, since probably most people don't know what belief propagation is. I'm sure there's a few people in the audience, the computer science ones who do. Let me first talk a little bit about what classical belief propagation is and why this is a useful thing. So suppose we have, I'll put this all in physics terminology. Suppose we have some Hamiltonian, and it's a classical Hamiltonian. So it's sum over I and J, some Jij, Sci, Szj. And you want to know something about the statistical properties of this system at a non-zero temperature. Work out, for example, what's the expectation value? Perhaps we add some magnetic field. What's the expectation value of a certain spin, or the expectation value of a spin-spin correlation function? And you don't want to do this by brute force on a computer. Maybe it's too hard to actually do the partition function sum. But let's assume that these Jij come from some real, like some spin glass Hamiltonian. They're given to you. It's not just that someone says, here's the probability distribution of the Jij. Work out for me in some replica theory what the statistics are. But they say, here's the Jij. Tell me, you know, what's the expectation value of this spin-spin correlation for these two spins? And so you actually have to go work it out. So one of the first things you might try would be to do mean field theory. Let's say we're at a non-zero temperature. So for mean field theory, you would come up with some equations, and I'm not going to bother to write them down. You would write down that some expectation value of a certain spin SZ was some, well, I'm sure you all know what the mean field equations are. It's some function of the spins J, which neighbor that particular spin I. And so you would have some self-consistent set of equations for the expectation values of the spins, and you could iterate these equations until you hit some fixed point and hope maybe this is a good description of what goes on within the system. And this is a reasonable thing to do, but there's a much better thing to do for many models, and this is called belief propagation, and it's closely related to what we call the cavity method in statistical physics. Let's suppose that these Jij... Well, there may be multiple solutions. So this would give you one solution, for example, from the mean field, and you might have to start in the right place to converge to the good one. So suppose these Jij instead describe some sort of sparse graph. So I'm just drawing lines to indicate, say, this is a site I, this is a site J, and this would be a Jij that was not equal to zero. So wherever we put a line, we would have a non-zero Jij. So suppose these Jij are on some sparse graph. And then in this case, the mean field equations would have this expectation value on this spin being a function of the expectation values on the spins nearby. But if this sparse graph were actually a tree, if it's actually a tree, you know, oh, we can solve this exactly. On a tree, we can exactly solve what goes on. Even if we put some magnetic fields on, you can exactly solve what goes on. And if you want to find out what's the expectation value of this spin, what you do is you take the expectation values of the leaves and you propagate them towards the root. You propagate towards the root, and you work out the expectation value that way. And it's an exact solution on the tree. So the idea behind belief propagation is to take that exact solution on the tree and turn it into an exact solution, not an exact solution, an approximate, very good, in practice, incredibly useful solution on sparse graphs where the loops are long. So this keeps on going and keeps on going, and locally it looks very tree-like, but eventually everything meets up again. There's a finite number of nodes. It's not a tree. There's loops, but the loops tend to be quite long, and you have some sparse graph, and you'll have some equations. So what will these be equations for? They're not equations just for the expectation value of the spin on a site. What you do, so let me sort of rephrase how you solve things on a tree. The way you solve things on a tree is we imagine directing things towards the root like that. So, and we would take these two spins and work out an expectation value here. We would take these two and work something out here. And we would take this and propagate it up. When we were doing it on a tree then, we were working out the expectation value of this spin depending just on these ones below it in the tree and ignoring the interaction with the spin above it. Then we would take the interaction with the spin above it and propagate that up towards the spin above it. So on the tree, you're working out expectation values of spins dependent on everything lower in the tree and propagating upwards. So you do the same trick in a graph. You work out, you say, we're working out the expectation value of this spin in the graph with this bond removed. Then we also work out the expectation value of this spin in the graph with this bond removed, and then we propagate them like that.
But you have to have an arbitrary field on the site.
Well, let's say there's also fields on the site. I mean, so let's say our Hamiltonian has also some HI, SCI, like that. So then we're working out expectation. I mean, otherwise, of course, there would be. Otherwise, you might have a symmetry breaking solution by chance. But here we can put some explicit breaking in, too. So for each site, you work out on this graph three different expectation values. The expectation value with this bond removed, the expectation value with this bond removed, the expectation value with that bond removed. And you propagate these expectation values through the tree. And then when you want to know the expectation value at this central site, you propagate from here, here, and here. And then you can finally extract these desired things, the expectation value on certain sites. So this is an incredibly useful method in practice.
So sorry, how do you reconcile the different values, like with the different bonds removed?
How do I finally find out what this value is here?
Yeah.
Well, so I have some value, if we pretend that it's a tree that these never met up, then I have some value on the graph with this bond removed, some on the graph with this bond removed, some on the graph with this bond removed. So now I just have to say it's reduced to solving sort of a four-site problem, which is that there's some expectation value of this spin, which looks like a magnetic field on this spin. There's some effective magnetic field on this spin, and this spin, and from that I can then work out what the actual field is on the central spin. So this may sound like just a lot of formalism, but it's actually incredibly practical, and it's used all the time to do things like this problem or to decode error-correcting codes, actually certain algorithms for decoding so-called low-density parity check codes, which are an important class of codes, use exactly this algorithm. It's very fast, very efficient, very effective. It's not just a theoretical curiosity. And now we'd like to do something similar within the quantum world. We'd like to do a similar problem within the quantum world. And I'm going to talk about stuff that's joint work of myself and David Poulin and Matt Leifer. Yeah, Kirill. Yeah.
Would you find anything other than limit field solution as far as the critical?
You're not gonna find new critical exponents or something like that. You know, you're gonna find mean field critical exponents. But if your question is, you know, you give me a 10,000 spin model with some particular JIJ and you say work this out, short of doing, you know, extensive Monte Carlo, this is the quickest way to do it.
So just
Yeah, it's a and you can think in a way how it differs from mean field is that it's careful about not overcounting. Like in mean field, I have an expectation value of this spin which depends upon this neighbor, but this neighbor's expectation value depends back on this spin, so somehow I'm like, you know, overcounting back and forth, and this kind of gets rid of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So on the boundary, right. So. What's that?
Well, suppose that that's not maybe correct, that the ground state doesn't of the easing model won't be polarized or tips of the tree.
So if we had some initial magnetic field on the boundaries, then that's our starting point, is the magnetic field on the boundaries. And so but that's just that then the boundary spin without interacting with the rest is polarized.
And
yeah, I mean, whatever our boundary conditions are, we propagate them in. Yeah, whatever the boundary conditions are, we propagate them in. If it's free, then we see. If it were free, then we wouldn't. If there were really no magnetic fields and on a tree, you wouldn't see anything. So you have to have some spins on the boundary. But if you put some loops in, and then you sort of carry this game of pretending that this tree solution is exact, even though you're doing it off a tree, then it can spontaneously break a symmetry. So if you have some weak magnetic field that you add just as a trial initial condition, you can see it grow or shrink, and so you can converge to different solutions. This I've described non-zero temperature ones. There's also zero temperature limit.
So he's calculating a complicated object where you have to take into account fluctuations. I mean, you guys are confusing me. He has an H, and he's calculating the trace of e to the minus beta H, so he doesn't have the spins on the leaves are not fixed.
Right, but I could put a very strong field, and then they'd be fixed.
You can, but I don't think...
So
I could.
This is
beta pyrrhals. This is just a way to do beta pyrrhals for things with loops. It's kind of a neat trick. Like, if you understand beta pyrrhals, you understand this, but I think it's a leap that someone made to decide to do it off of a tree. No, you just forget about the fact that the things connect. You just keep bringing them in. So you just keep propagating around the tree as if there were no loops.
The key point, this is spin a half, right?
No, it doesn't matter. These could be any classical degrees of freedom.
But then just knowing as Z won't cut.
Any classical degrees of freedom.
If you have general spins, what you propagate is actually conditional.
Yeah. I mean, I should really write probability of up, probability of down, and so on. I should really write a full probability distribution.
So what you mean is a recursion formula?
What's that?
It's a recursion relation.
It's a recursion relation. Yes, yes, yes.
So you start with an algorithm that in the tree case would halt, you know, and yes. Here you have an algorithm that you just keep running for.
In the tree case, it would halt and it would be inexact, and here we keep running it and it's good in practice.
Okay.
And now we'd like the same thing in the quantum world. Uh-huh. We'd like to do the same thing in the quantum world.
So are you going to talk about the cases where the leaf propagation fails, like problems?
No, I'm not going to talk. I mean, except for a bit in motivation as to why it's interesting in the quantum world. I mean, actually, it's good for a lot of spin glass problems, depending upon what phase you're in. I mean, there are phases where it fails and phases where it works well. And so, in principle, we might also want a quantum survey propagation as a better way of doing well in those phases. But let's first do the quantum belief, as there are many phases where this works well. And there, so as I say, applications would be decoding error correcting codes, finding statistical properties of states like this. And it is the cavity method in statistical physics. So now let's talk about in the quantum world. So in the quantum world, I have some Hamiltonian, which is now not necessarily diagonal in some basis. You know, maybe there's also some SX term, for example, added onto the Hamiltonian. And I'd like to understand how to do something similar. So let me for a moment forget about the tree. Let's just make the simplest case, which is the line. Now, it may be, you know, skipping over too much, but since I sort of roughly sketched how in the classical world you went from doing the tree without loops to this graph with loops, in the quantum world, I'm going to start with the simplest possible tree without loops, which is the line, and then you can, by analogy, guess what we would do on the complicated loopy graph in the quantum world. So I'm just going to start with the case of the line as a warm-up for explaining what we want to do. So as Bert was saying, you know, really what we're doing is we're propagating a probability distribution of this n spin. So there would be a probability up and a probability down is all we need classically. Quantum mechanically, obviously we need a density matrix on the last spin. So if this is the n spin, you might think, oh, okay, what we need is rho of n, the reduced density matrix on spin n. This is not sufficient. This is not sufficient. And the reason is that there may be some entanglement over a longer range. So in order to get a good approximation, you need to take an interval of a few spins. The more you take, the more computer work you do, but at the same time, the more accurate your method becomes. So you might take rho of n minus 2 up to n, for example. That's what I've drawn here. Or n minus 3 or n minus 4. You know, the more work you choose to do, the more accurate you get. And from that, this is the density matrix on the chain consisting of these first few spins. From that, you'll work out a density matrix on one more spin and one more spin and so on, and you'll be able to propagate this density matrix along the chain. I'm not going to go into equations that let you do it. There's been a couple formalisms we've developed. The one that's closest to how I've outlined is, I'm going to explain one we recently developed that's a little easier to explain the formalism. The one that's closest to how I've outlined, you need a length that scales with the inverse temperature. So you sort of have an entanglement length that's 1 over the temperature. But you can propagate correlations for a very long length. So you can have a correlation length that's exponential in the temperature of classical correlations, and yet these very short-range quantum correlations. So you need this density matrix to track the quantum correlations. So this was my method of doing it. David Poulin and Matt Leifer had a similar but related way. And then recently, David and I came up with sort of another way of doing it, which is what I want to explain, which is most closely related to problems of topology in quantum systems and problems that are, well, that hopefully other people will find interesting. So the approach we had is something like this. It's a variational approach, although it's a weird variational approach. It's the opposite of what you might normally do. So suppose we have a collection of, now let's say we just have a finite chain of n spins. And suppose you know the reduced density matrix on all these little subintervals. So you know the reduced density matrix on the first three spins, the next three spins, the next three spins. Sorry, I'm messing up these tape down here. So you know the reduced density matrix on each of these few spins. Now, not necessarily can you reconstruct the whole original state from these local density matrices, but let's ask for some conditions under which you can do this. What we're interested in, we're looking at problems at non-zero temperature, so we're interested in the free energy, the energy minus the temperature times the entropy. If we knew all the local density matrices, we could work out what the energy is, because the energy is a local operator. So if you told us the exact local density matrices, we could work out the energy. But how would we work out the entropy of the global state? We know all these local density matrices, but it's sort of a tough problem. So here we use a resulting quantum information theory called strong subadditivity. And it says that if you have three regions, A, B, and C, and you have density matrices on these three regions, that the entropy on region AB, that's SAB is the entropy of the reduced density matrix on region AB, plus the entropy on region BC minus the entropy on B minus the entropy on ABC is positive. This is a result due to Lieben-Ruskaya, and it's a hard theorem to prove, but it's actually equivalent. It actually implies the statement that Levin and Wen's topological entanglement entropy always has a certain sign. It implies that statement, so it's actually comes back to stuff that we consider nowadays. So why is this interesting? This is interesting because if we set it so that I want to choose a particular configuration. I want to make this spin n. I want to make this spins 1 up to, let's say, n minus k, where k is some integer, and this the interval in between, n minus k plus 1 up to n minus 1. So this is the last spin. These are the spins here, and this is this. What you find is that then the entropy of the whole, if we move this over to the other side, the entropy of the whole system is at most the entropy of these, so we can just rewrite it as SABC, is at most the entropy of SAB plus SBC minus SB. This is just a rewriting. And this guy is the difference in entropy between this density matrix and a slightly shorter density matrix. This is the key step. So this is the density matrix on the last few spins. This is what we get by tracing one spin out of it. We can compute the difference of these two entropies. So this entropy minus this one. And we can iterate this relation. And so we can add up. We can say we take the entropy from these three minus these two, plus the entropy from these three minus these two, plus the entropy from these three minus these two, and so on, and keep going. And this is an upper bound to the true entropy. It's a variational upper bound to the true entropy, meaning it gives us a variational lower bound to the true free energy. So the method we considered was to imagine that all these local density matrices are variational parameters. They're required to be consistent. Wherever they overlap, they have to describe the same state. Their energy is just what you expect, and we compute the global entropy in this way. You have, you just take the entropy on a density matrix minus the entropy on a slightly shorter density matrix, and that's sort of the entropy from adding the last spin, and you just keep on repeating. And the question is, how well does this work? And in fact, it works quite well. We were considered it even in the worst case. You can consider this thing in models like these trees, and the length of this interval you need depends upon the temperature, and then it gives you a way of propagating information through the trees, and you can study quantum spin glasses, and you can obtain some very efficient results. It's an efficient way to calculate. You need some fast way to calculate because you have lots of disorder on the tree. It's an efficient way to do decoding of quantum error correcting codes, but we decided to actually try it in the very worst case to see how it would do, and the worst case would be a graph with lots of loops, so a two-dimensional lattice. So we did a two-dimensional lattice, and we added we had patches, little square patches, where we assumed we knew the density matrix. Those were our variational quantities. And we got the entropy by the difference in the entropy on this patch minus the patch with the one spin in the top corner removed. And that corresponds to a particular addition sequence of spins to the lattice where you add them along a line, and then along the next line, and along the next line, and so on. And it works. It gives you more accurate answers for free energy than exact diagonalization would for the same numerical effort. You don't have to diagonalize very big systems. You have to do thermodynamic calculations. But effectively, this sort of does a smarter boundary condition. It's not like a fixed boundary condition. It's not a free boundary condition. It's just some boundary condition of consistency between these density matrices. And so one of the last things I'd like to mention about this is the relationship between this and topological entanglement entropy and topologically ordered states. Because as I mentioned, this strong subadditivity implies a statement about topological entanglement entropy. So I'd like to comment on where that is. If strong subadditivity is saturated, if this is exactly equal to zero, then you can show that you can construct the reduced density matrix on this ABC from the reduced density matrix on AB and the reduced density matrix on BC. There's an exact way of reconstructing one density matrix from the other two when you're just saturating this. Otherwise, there's some freedom. You don't know the global state from the local. But if it's saturated, you can work out the global state from the local state. And so the question is, well, what cases can you do this? Where can you have physical systems where you can work out the global state just given the local state? Surprisingly, actually, depends on your addition order. If you consider, say, the toric code or any other topologically ordered models, the toric code with this particular addition order, you can work out the local state given the global state. We have what we call it a Markov shield, in a sense that when we added this site, the correlations on these sites completely shield this site from everything else. So the conditional mutual information between this site and these, which is how well that is saturated, is exactly zero. So you can exactly reconstruct, if you do it this way, the global state from the local state. But you wind up having to deal with very large regions. So although you reconstruct the global state from the local state, you do it in a way that requires keeping track of some very large regions, because the state you construct sort of has a very large, large boundary. So you might try to do it in another way. You might try to do it in a way where you don't have to do that. So what you might want to do instead is to, probably I shouldn't even draw the square lattice. Let's just say that you first construct your state on a bunch of circles. Then what you do is you decide you're going to close off the circles by filling in the state in here and doing this here, and then finally filling in the patch in the center. The trouble that happens when you do that is that as soon as you close off the square, you find this is the topological entanglement entropy. It's non-zero. You don't saturate the strong subadditivity, so you can't reconstruct the state around this square just given the local states on here. So it depends upon how you reconstruct it, and this is a property that will arise for the topologically ordered states but will not arise for the other states. So to summarize that, it's possible to use this to reconstruct a global state from a local state, but the particular order you do it will depend upon whether or not the particular orders you can use to do that will depend upon whether or not your state is topologically ordered. And I think that's what I wanted to say about topological order in this setting. One last thing I'll mention is that it's possible to also describe, in cases where this is saturated, to completely describe what states look like on trees. So if you have a quantum state on a tree, like I've drawn here, and you have some saturation of strong subadditivity in the same sense, what you're really describing is a very simple state where there's just local entanglement across each of these bonds here. And then you have some classical distribution on top of that. You have some classical Markov process, or just some classical Hamiltonian, which effectively determines which quantum state you get on each bond. So you have some very limited states that you can have on these lattices without loops when you have this saturation. Otherwise, you have much more rich states that you can get when you have this topological order. So let me just sort of summarize by saying what this was good for. This is one thing that's nice is this is a new potentially useful numerical method that lets you get variational lower bounds to the free energy, which is exactly opposite to what you normally get. It's a method that allows you to study quantum systems which have lots of disorder in them. So if you have some quantum spin glass on a tree and you want to ask what does the state look like somewhere, you can propagate density matrices on the leaves of the tree and just keep propagating, and do this fast enough, because you just have to do a local calculation each time you propagate, that you can do statistical averages over large ensembles, which you wouldn't be able to do if you had to actually go diagonalize the Hamiltonian at every step, and yet you still include quantum correlations. And the last thing I'll mention is that David Poulin and Matt Leifer have shown that this method is useful for doing decoding of quantum error correcting codes, that there's certain quantum error correcting codes and certain types of noise where the efficient way to decode it is to solve some quantum statistical mechanics problem at non-zero temperature, and the most efficient way they found to do that was to use quantum belief propagation, and they were able to test this and not prove anything but show numerically that it provided very efficient ways of doing error correction in software. So let me stop here. Thanks.
This reminds me a little of what Gottfried Feydel was doing, where you sort of you try to reason about a global state using local density matrices only. Could you say anything about the relationship?
I don't know Giffray's work where he was trying to work out a global state from local.
Well, you try to calculate at least expectation values. So.
I mean, you're not referring to Mera, are you?
Huh?
You're not referring to Mera.
Well, to where you have a one-dimensional spin chain, where you have some assumption about limited entanglement.
Right. I mean, it's related in a sense that a lot of these things are methods for trying to keep a limited amount of information about the state and yet still describe enough to describe the local state. There's some philosophical differences here, I guess, but that's similar.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a more meaningful answer than that. There's Eduardo behind you.
Conventional bit of Pythagoras approximation is not exact for a quantum system. In other words, you cannot solve it on a tree.
Exactly.
So what's different?
Exactly. So this is why I was saying back on a line.
Even though there are no loops.
Exactly. This is what I was saying. Even on a line,
yes.
On a quantum system, it's not possible. Yeah, it's not even possible to propagate the reduced density matrix on the last site. Mm-hmm. What you can do is you say, I'll propagate the reduced density matrix on the last 3 sites or 5 sites or however much computer power you want to expend. And then you'll get a good approximation if the entanglement does not extend longer than that range. So it's never going to be exact, unless you happen to be in one of these Hamiltonians, which is sums of commuting projector Hamiltonians. But it's not going to be exact, but it's very accurate if the length that you keep is long enough. So it's a way to do beta pyrals, but it does require a significant change in that.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Matt again. Thank you.